ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time for your Tuesday. Corbin Middlemass with you. There is no Ed Cowan today, but I'm very pleased to say we have more than a suitable replacement. He's a man who's been in and around cricket his whole life. He was born into a cricketing family. He is the current chief executive of the ACA, and his name is Paul Marsh. And I'm pleased to say he joins me on the ABC Cricket Podcast. Paul, appreciate your time.
Great to be chatting, Corbin. I've been looking forward to this.
So we cross over, you and I, obviously, the footy and cricket interests and everything else. You've come out of the footy landscape after more than a decade with the Players Association there, and now you're back in your first true love in cricket. What's it like being back in the cricket universe?
It's been great, actually. It's a change I needed. I think, you know, 11 years in the footy environment, I've said a few times, felt like probably about 111 years. It's a pretty issue-rich environment, so... not to say cricket's not, but it's probably a little quieter. And I think the issues that we're dealing with in cricket now are extremely interesting. So, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but private investment in the Big Bash League, obviously an international game that is at a pretty interesting stage at the moment. So, yeah, I've really enjoyed being back and reconnecting with a lot of people, including Ed. Shame he's not here today, but but also just dealing with some new issues and some pretty important issues in the game of cricket.
What do you take from your 11 years at the AFL Players Association back to cricket with you?
Apart from a lot of grey hairs, I think football, probably one of the things that's been really stark to me coming back into cricket is the level of interest in cricket compared to footy. Footy's at another scale. And I think that I've been finding myself asking the questions around what does cricket need to do to generate more interest. I think that's probably footy's greatest strength, but also its greatest weakness. And I think, you know, with that level of interest does come a lot of issues that take up a lot of space. Some of them are probably, you know, big issues. Some of them are probably on the other end of the scale. But I think the level of interest is really what drives the game. And I think that's something that, you know, cricket can learn a little bit from. Probably somewhere in the middle between the two would be a nice happy medium. But a lot of the issues we deal with as a players association are similar across both sports. But I think, you know, with the just with the international part of cricket, I think there's some unique issues as well. So I think it was certainly a good 11 years, and I loved it. I don't think there's an issue that I haven't seen. So I think that puts you in good stead for whatever might come our way. But I probably shouldn't say that, because who knows what's coming.
I wasn't planning to start with this, but you sort of alluded to it, the interest and the way the game's covered, that happens, you know, footy versus cricket. I say it all the time on this podcast that I feel like when the summer months roll around, I almost have to even pull back what we do, like another 10%, 20% or whatever, that it feels like the cricketers have maybe rabbit ears in a way that the footballers don't, for example. Do you find that with the playing cohort, that the cricketers sort of hear a lot more, consume a lot more, and maybe a little bit more sensitive to it than perhaps a football club? And I know there's probably various other factors at case there too, where there's only 11 of those. The positions are very, you know, role-based and specific, whereas in a football club, you know, you're one of 40-odd or whatever it turns out to be. Maybe it's easier to protect you from the outside noise. But do you find that different in the way the players at least perceive the coverage and the interest in what they do?
Oh, to be honest, not really. I mean, I think it's the point you make about the number of players is very relevant. And I think the spotlight on the top athletes in both sports is very high. I mean, I think that the level of attention that our top athletes get, particularly in these two sports, is pretty similar. But you know, I think we ask a lot of our top cricketers because there are so few of them. And, you know, I think that is one of cricket's great weaknesses. I think we need to expand the number of players who the public are interested in, because it's a lot to ask of a small group to sort of carry the sport. And, I mean, ultimately every sport depends on the fans and the engagement between the fans and the players. And so, you know, I think that's why the Big Bash is an important competition product for the sport, because that does expand the number of players that, you know, can be used to promote and market the sport.
We had a couple of clashes over the summer, so most notably obviously Usman Khawaja on the back of his back injury over in Perth. Even in more recent times, Cam Green and his reported clash with a journalist at a Sheffield Shield game. As the head of the Players Association, do you duck in those moments and say, hey, is everything all right here? How's it all going, the relationship between the Fourth Estate and the players?
Yeah, we do. And I think, you know, it's It is just a check-in, really. I mean, I think our, and this is probably also a slight difference with the international players. They've got a lot of experience around dealing with media, and I think they tend to roll with it pretty well as a general comment. But you know, there's always whatever the issue might be. Like, part of our role is to check in with the players and see if they need any support. And sometimes players do, sometimes they don't. But you know, those sorts of issues are all what I guess keeps the wheel spinning in the sport.
Absolutely. The big issue that's going on in the game at the moment is clearly around privatisation and what the game's going to do with the Big Bash teams. We've spoken a lot about it here on this channel. What's your understanding on where the process is at the moment? So we saw the reports, obviously, that essentially five of the six states had said yes. Two of them are a soft yes with a couple of caveats on it, and then New South Wales were ultimately a no. What do you understand as the head of the Players Association is the next step from here?
I think just taking it back one step, there's broadly three different parts to this process if it's going to happen. And the first part is clearly CA and the states reaching agreement. And I think you've probably pretty accurately described it there. Our understanding is that Queensland aren't there yet at the moment, but they're still working through that. If and when that may happen, the next part of the process is Cricket Australia need to do a deal with us. And so they can't push ahead with privatisation without renegotiating our what's called our memorandum of understanding. So that's the critical part of this, because if that doesn't happen, then this doesn't proceed. And then if that happens, they then would move to trying to secure the investors. So there's still a fair bit to play out in this process.
That was my next question. Is the MOU fit for purpose? Is it fit for purpose in the landscape as it currently stands?
Well, I mean, it's probably just important to know that the MOU doesn't contemplate CA pushing down this path and bringing in private investors, so it does need to be renegotiated. What's clear to us is that a new deal has to be done for CA to actually push down this path. So I think they acknowledge that. So we are in those discussions at the moment, and I'd say that at the moment we're a fair way apart in terms of what that might look like. And so that'll play out as they always do over the coming period of time. But that's a very important part of this process, equally as important as the
Yeah.
state and CA process.
So I guess that, I mean, this might be, how long's a piece of string, but that these negotiations, and yeah, I work for the ABC, this has been tracking on a period now, but how long is that likely to take? Like, how and when would you have to get to the table? Because I know the states feel this way in our conversations with Ed, and clearly the players do as well. It feels like Cricket Australia are keen to kind of put their foot on the gas here, and yet it feels like there's lots that still needs to be worked out. What would the timeline be on something like that, being able to redraw an MOU?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to answer. I mean, I've done a lot of these across both cricket and footy, and they tend to take a long time. You tend to start a long way apart and then eventually get to a point where you reach an agreement. But sometimes that can be, that can be very drawn out, and sometimes that can be very testy. And right now, where we're at with Cricket Australia is we are a long way apart. So, I mean, it could take a decent period of time. In saying that, where my experience is where there's will on both sides, you can accelerate the negotiations. So, certainly from an ACA perspective, we're ready, willing, and able to push through this as quick as CA want to. But it's got to be a deal that we're happy with. There's a fair way to go there. So I don't know. CA certainly have put some pretty ambitious timeframes around this whole project that my sense is they're a little way behind on at the moment. And that doesn't even factor in our negotiations. So I think there's a lot to do.
When it comes to changes to the MOU, can you give us any specifics as to things that would need to be worked through?
Yeah, I mean, look, we've put a proposal to Cricket Australia that captures the objectives that we have, and there's seven of them. And without going into all the detail, there are financial aspects to this that what's driving even Cricket Australia's push to privatise here is making sure that we've got the best players, not only in Australia but also around the world, that are able to play in our Big Bash competitions. Because we're at a point now where, we're probably ranked about five in the men's Big Bash or men's T20 competitions, and probably third now in the women's competitions in terms of what we're paying the top players. So, that trajectory isn't a positive one for Australian cricket. So we need to make sure we're securing the players. But I think equally importantly, we need a system here that is still going to attract the best young athletes to play cricket. And if we don't do that, and that filters right down to state cricket, then we're going to potentially lose them to other sports. So it's a pivotal time in the game. I think for us, if we are going to bring private investors into this country and these competitions, we need to make sure we've got the right set of controls around that. There are things that we're all worried about in bringing in third parties, and we've put some things to Cricket Australia that we think need to be agreed if we're going to support this. There are other parts to this, that we've put to CA as well, and we need to continue to push forward on our path that we've been on around gender equity, make sure that development programs, etc., are in place for the players. So they're the sorts of things that we've put to CA, and we've been very clear that we need to make sure they're met if we're going to do this deal.
Do you feel like you're being heard?
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly meeting with Cricket Australia, and they understand what we're looking for. And on the flip side, they've got some things they want to achieve out of this. So, being heard is not necessarily the problem, but getting to an agreement is still where we're trying to work towards.
Give us a zoomed out lens. Like, do the players get polled at all as to how they feel about privatisation, whether they want it, whether they don't? Does their opinion matter on it? Have you got some pros and cons as to what's good and what's bad for the game from a player's point of view if they do go down this path of privatising the BBL?
Yeah, I mean, look, we ran a process late last year when this was first being talked about, where we went around. I personally was part of these meetings and met with all the playing groups. We started talking about it, explain what it meant and what it would potentially look like. And then we actually got the players in the rooms to stand up and go, for example, go to the left-hand side if you're supportive, go to the right-hand side if you're not, and if you're not sure, stand in the middle or put yourself on that spectrum. And that then led to a series of excellent conversations around, okay, well, what are you worried about or why do you support it? So we actually had those conversations with all the groups. We also polled them sort of officially through surveying. So we've got enough data to suggest that, and I think this is really where the position is for us, is like we're open to it if the deal that is put in place here covers the things that we're looking for, but we're not unconditionally supportive of privatisation, because it's probably that classic risk and reward type situation. Is if it's actually worth doing, then we're up for it. But if it's not, then we are introducing some things into Australian cricket that maybe we don't think are something we would unconditionally support.
Yeah, sounds similar to the Queensland and South Australia sort of position on where they sit with it at the moment at state level. Can you give us an insight on those percentages? Is that public as to how the players voted?
No, it's not, and I'd rather not. But I
Yep.
think, but again, I just would reinforce the point that it's not an unconditional position from the players. It's not like they've just said, we are
Yep, let's do
gagging
it.
to bring in private investors. It's what does it actually look like? And that's a series of trade-offs and needs to be negotiated through. But we have got clarity on what it would take for us to get to that point.
How regularly are the players briefed on, the process, what happens next, the next steps in it? Like, how regularly would you chat to them on where the process
Yeah,
is at?
pretty regularly. I mean, we have a what we call a delegate structure. So every team's got two player delegates who are our leaders within the group, and we're having, catch-ups with them every couple of weeks at the moment online. But then communicating with the broader playing group, as there are important milestones to update them on. So I think the players have been well communicated with, and that is going to continue because this is quite fluid at the moment.
Private ownership, obviously, in other sports, has various owners from various parts of the world. But what about the players themselves? Have you had any expression from any of the players to actually want to get involved, whether it's as a minority share owner or whatever it turns out to be? And will that be prioritised in the process to be able to get our players to actually be part of an ownership group?
I think, yeah, I mean, there's definitely been a few players who have asked the question. I think probably as much out of curiosity as anything else. With respect to, if we get through the first two gates that I've described, the states are supportive and we get to an agreement with CA, it'll then move to, what the investment piece looks like. And I think potentially there might be some players as part of consortiums there. And I think, that'll then be a deal between the player and Cricket Australia. And I think, whoever they're talking to from an investor's perspective. So we wouldn't stop that. But it's not necessarily something that we're specifically trying to negotiate in, as the players will take some sort of ownership structure.
It's a pretty fascinating time in the history of the game, and not in the least the fact that the guy that was previously the head of the Players Association is now running the governing body in Todd Greenberg, and you come in, obviously, returning to the role, obviously, there as the chief executive at the ACA. How do you find your relationship with Todd? We're a guy who sort of put a lot of these processes in place, the MOU and everything else, and now he's got to manage it from the other side of the fence. How do you go in your role, which is also his previous role?
Yeah, look, I've known Todd for quite a few years. We actually sat on a board together when I was running the AFL Players Association. He was running the ACA. And look, he's got a job to do, as do I. I'm sure there will be times through this where he's adopting positions that are the opposite of what he'd previously adopted. And I'm also sure that I'll make sure he knows that. So I'm sure we're both adults and, you know, we'll work through this. He's got a tough job, as do I. It's just, you know, we've got to do the best for our constituents here, and that's the reality of it. So, we'll work through this from an ACA perspective to get to the outcome that our players need, but also obviously always with one eye on what's important for the game. So I'd like to think we can find a way through, but I'm sure there'll be some testing times ahead.
We obsess, particularly in the media, because maybe we don't understand these things on a deeper level like you guys do, that obviously work in it and do it as your daily gig, about, you know, things like percentages, for example. So you had success, obviously, at the AFL in 2023 in the last CBA, where essentially you went up to over 37% of the game's revenue. You compare that to cricket, which was 26% and actually had a hike last time out to get to 30. Is that important as to what that number looks like? And is there an ideal figure that you're actually striving for, that you feel like is fair for both parties?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's public knowledge that we are pushing for a higher percentage as part of this deal. And, we're believers, and I'm personally a believer in the model where you tie what the players get paid to a share of the game's revenues. The players generate the revenues, and it's appropriate that they're incentivized and aligned in a way where if the game grows, they grow with it. We think this is, if this were to happen, it's a fundamental shift in the business model of cricket. And as such, you know, the players are the ones that generate the value and have grown the value of these teams. So we think it's appropriate the players would receive a higher percentage, and we're pushing for that at the moment. That's still ahead of us. We haven't got there, and that'll be a fundamental as part of our final agreement.
Is there a magic number?
I'm not going to talk to it, Corbin, but, we've obviously put some detail to Cricket Australia, and that's to be negotiated.
Ed Cowan on this channel talks about the player payment model, and he's spoken about it in the past, that the best players deserve more, talking about, you know, global benchmarking and obviously where the stars are and the fact that these are star-driven leagues. He's spoken about the fact that he feels like it's certainly out of whack, particularly with other franchise competitions. And the thing that he's highlighted in the past is, you know, for lack of a better term, an inflated middle class, where he feels like, you know, that the middle class cricketer in Australia that isn't particularly in demand is overpaid, and maybe we could redistribute some of those funds. So basically, rather than sort of overpaying the guys in the middle, some of that money goes to the top guys to be able to match market forces. What do you make of that as a way to restructure, I guess, the way that we, like, the same payment pool, but distributed differently based on, you know, star factor and a global interest?
Yeah, I've had this chat with Ed, and it does make me laugh when I hear, you know, players who've benefited from the system all of a sudden wanting to rip parts of the system up. That's a little drive-by, Ed, if you're listening. But I think we've got to take this back and have a look at the broader view of what actually makes our system as great as what it's been. And it's not just the top players. There's a system from the pathways that allows the players to develop to become the top players. And if we start pulling back from what our minimum salaried players are getting and what our middle classes, you've referred to them, are playing, like, the flow-on effect is really potentially that, firstly, we don't attract the players to come and want to pursue a career in cricket. And there's plenty of other options for the talented young athletes out there, and some of them are a lot easier to pursue than cricket. And then I think in terms of the depth in our system, from which is where our best players develop from, is potentially going to be challenged. So I don't think it's as simple as going, we don't want to pay the players more in a collective sense, so we'll just redistribute from the bottom to the top. If we start to think like that, I personally, and I know the ACA more broadly, would have real concerns about what that would do to our system. So we don't think that's the answer. I reject it. I've said that to Ed privately, and there are others who have similar views. But this is not the answer to fixing, you know, what Australian cricket's problems are at the moment, in our view.
When I hear Pat Cummins talk, I always think, you know, very smart guy. You know, he doesn't say anything by accident as well, and he's obviously a great, you know, statesman of Australian cricket and a great figurehead and leader for the game. What did you hear when you heard him talk about the fact that we don't want to keep making players choose between, you know, going to the 100, for example, and earning big bucks there, as opposed to playing, you know, top end series against Bangladesh? What did you hear when those comments came out?
That's not a new point. When I was doing this job last time, we were talked to this point. You know, this has been a scheduling issue for many, many years. And we continue to put players in a position where they're choosing between country and club. And the reality is that the money is increasing all the time in the club option compared to the country option. And I think we're getting close. We're already seeing it in other countries where players have already made those decisions. And so to think that's not going to happen, you know, more frequently in Australian cricket is just completely naive. So what I thought was, yes, that's where it's going. And the reality of, and this is not just an athlete perspective, is people will choose, you know, where the best financial outcomes are coming from. And so cricket has got a problem here that it needs to work through. And even if you go back 12 or so months ago when the World Cricketers Association produced its report into the future structure of the game, these are the issues that have been raised. Like, we need to actually separate the, you know, international cricket and club cricket, or players are going to push down the club path. So I think that's just a signal that this is real and it's coming and we need to do something about it.
Do you think the players are worried about how they'll be perceived if they do make that decision?
I think that's an individual. That's up to individuals. There'll be some that potentially are and there'll be some that aren't. But as I said, there are players from all around the world that already made these choices and it's coming to Australian cricket. And so, yes, there might be some backlash, but I don't think that's necessarily what's going to be driving the players' decisions. They do genuinely love, our guys genuinely and girls, genuinely love playing for their country and they want to do both. But don't make them keep choosing, or they may choose where the more lucrative pathway is. And like, even just when you consider where the Big Bash competitions are going, you know, if we bring in a set of owners here who own teams in five or six different markets, like, we're heading to a world where the primary contracting party will be the franchise. And so players may actually not get choice of playing for their country if the schedules are competing.
You have spoken about this in the past and you're an expansionist. You think very well about the game and about what it would look like and everything else. What would the ideal schedule look like? If you had a blank piece of paper and you could say we can get together, not just as maybe Australian cricket, but even the game globally, what's the way forward, do you think? It feels like we need to, whatever we're doing at the moment with the FTP, it clearly feels like we're going to need something as we head into the new world and whatever unfolds over the next decade.
Is how long you got? I think there's, it's not a simple question, but I think the reality of it is, I think we do need to create windows for international cricket. So we need to carve them out. And that was part of the report I just spoke about. That way there's no T20 competitions competing with them and therefore players don't have to choose. I do think we need less international cricket. And I think probably the third thing I would say is, you know, I think it's extremely important that, you know, we get down to a point where every game that we're playing internationally has context. So, you know, limited overs games are counting towards World Cup qualification and, you know, the public actually can understand why we're playing a, you know, a three-match one-day series against whoever it might be, whereas cricket has gone a long way away from that. You know, there's so much cricket that is, you know, played for apparently no reason other than to generate income. And where there's no context, the interest is waning. So I think they're the changes that I think are needed to be made. And if we can carve out time in the schedule for that to happen, then I think players will be able to do both. But if we don't, if we keep having the overlap that we see now, like, there's just no doubt where the players are going to hit and international cricket will suffer from that.
So less bilateral white ball.
I think that's where we're at, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I think you can ramp up the bilateral white ball, you know, as you lead up to a World Cup, but it may be you don't play any ODIs for 2 years and then you ramp it up for 2 years leading into a World Cup, as an example.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's where it's going to go. Players love playing Test cricket still. They love playing in the big events, but some of the bilateral stuff, I think, is we've got to take a serious look at it.
What about at domestic level? Is there a better way we can do it than what we're doing currently? And obviously, depending on what happens with privatisation and where the Big Bash lands and the availability of the best players and all the rest of it. But what about even the One Day Cup and the Sheffield Shield? Do you have an idea on how we can better put that together over the summer months?
Oh, look, I think it's actually reasonably fit for purpose, and it's served us very well over a period of time. I think to follow on from the previous comment, though, if we're having a 2-year, period where we're not playing any international ODIs, for example, you probably have a look at, okay, maybe we ramp up T20 during those 2 years, because ultimately the state competitions are there to prepare the players for international competitions. That's a very male player focused answer. I think on the female side of things, we're a lot under in terms of how much cricket they're playing domestically. And so I think we need to be, and this is part of our MOU submission, we want more cricket for the female players.
Do you think the test matches, the men's test matches, will ever disappear from the calendar window and over the Christmas, New Year and Boxing Day and the New Year's test?
I hope not. I think, that's still a very significant part of our game. But I do think they're at risk. I mean, I think unless you're a very average cricket fan, you know, a lot of people wouldn't have a good sense of where test cricket's at outside of Australia and England. And, the signals aren't great there at the moment, but it's still it's the staple of our summer. And I think we've got to do what we can to protect that. And again, we've just got to make sure we can set up the schedule in a way that the players can play. And the Big Bash discussion is an interesting one because there is overlap with our test series. And, we talk about getting the best players playing, but we're actually putting a schedule in place here that doesn't even allow that ourselves. And that's something we can control. So I think there's a bit of work to be done there too.
All right, before you go, I always ask Ed these big picture questions. He loves it because it's, as I said earlier, how long's a piece of string and how could you possibly get your crystal ball out and predict? But where do you think we end up with this privatisation stuff? It feels like there's so much to work through, and I don't understand this space anywhere near as well as what Ed does. And yet I look at it and all I can think of is there's so much to work through and the timeline that they're on is seemingly short. Where are we going to get to, do you think, by the next couple of months or whatever on this?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I'd like to think we get to a point where there's a deal done between us and Cricket Australia for the players. That's a good one, and we can then all get behind an exciting new direction. But in the absence of that, I mean, I can certainly see us pausing this for a period of time and then seeing where it plays out. But there's still lots of questions to be answered, and a model that certainly we're not comfortable with at this point in time. So it's probably not a great answer to a good question, but I think we've got a little bit of time to play out here.
That was my next point. Does the timeline actually matter? Like, I know Cricket Australia want it done by a certain point, but does it actually matter to the players when it happens?
Oh, look, I think, it's probably a question without a simple answer, but I do think there's an element of my personal view is we need to get the right deal in place. Like, this is, we're potentially selling parts or all of teams forever, and I don't think we should be rushing that to try to get something in place over the space of a few weeks. Like, this is a big decision for everyone, and we need to make sure we get it right.
Paul, appreciate you carving out half an hour to chat with me. I always enjoy your insights on what's going on, and all the best with your role there as the Chief Executive at the Cricketers Association, at the ACA, as it is now. I keep thinking the Players Association, obviously, from the AFL days, but appreciate your insights as always, and we'll watch this space, as they say, to see what happens next.
Pleasure, and great to chat, Corbin.